Welcome to the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I'm your host, Chase Maxwell. Twenty-one years ago, the Friends began a storytelling series for adults. What could be better than sitting by the fire, sipping a hot cup of coffee or cider, while listening to some of the best writers Minnesota has to offer? Over the years, the Fireside series has featured a great range of authors, from Kate DiCamillo to Jack Weatherford, Carol Bly to Jack Elhai, making the winter just that much more bearable. The 2015 lineup is no exception. Well, there actually is one exception, and you're listening to it. For over 20 years, the Fireside series has drawn enthusiastic crowds to the beautiful, but small, Hamlin Midway Library, and this is one way we're celebrating that legacy, by broadcasting the entire season and reaching a larger audience. Episode 4 features writer and comedian Lorna Landvik reading from her new novel, Best to Laugh, which follows her latest irresistible character, Candy Pakala, from Minnesota to Hollywood as she pursues her dream of becoming a comedian. Landvik taps her own adventurous past as a comic performer and writes in her classic style. Sometimes so funny, you'll cry. Sometimes so sad, you might as well laugh. And always impossible to put down. Landvik is the best-selling author of many novels, including Patty Jane's House of Curl, Tall Pine Polka, and Mayor of the Universe. She has performed stand-up and improv comedy around the country and is also a public speaker, playwright, and actor, most recently seen in an all-improvised one-woman show, Party in the Rec Room. So sit back, hopefully with a hot cup of cider in hand, and get ready to be transported.
Fireplace. Wow. Whenever I'm in a library, thank you so much for coming, by the way. I know it's a cold night and you could be in front of the TV, but nothing's good on Wednesday anyway. But I always have to tell this story when I'm at a library. I live in Minneapolis. My local library is the Nokomis or the Roosevelt Library, but I always have to come into St. Paul because your libraries are open a lot more than ours. But I was sitting at the Nokomis Library by the fireplace that's never lit because of budget constraints. And this was years ago, and I was working on, I think, Angry Housewives Eating Bonbons. So I was sitting, working away, writing, and I was in the middle of a scene, and it was going well, and I heard a woman up at Miss Lucy, our librarian's, up at her desk, and she said, yes, say, do you have that that book, The Tall Pine Polka, by that Laura Lardvark? And I perked up a little, and Miss Lucy said, well, I'll check and see if we have the book, but if you'd like to speak to the author, she's right over there. So she came over, and I'm always very happy to talk to people, you know, if they've read my books, all the better, but this woman was a talker. Talk. I knew what was in her crock pot that night, you know. Talk. I knew that she was having trouble with fallen arches, you know. Talk. And I was really waiting to get back to the scene, and finally she realizes she has to go back home and attend to that crock pot. But before she does, she gets a diabolical look in her eye, and she says, you know, we've met before. And I said, really? All this time chatting, I had no idea. Where was that? And she said, well, I was the nurse at your colonoscopy. She hadn't recognized my face, I guess. Try to leave that all behind me. This could go on and on. So I'm going to talk about a lot of things, but I will talk about this book first because it's the closest autobiographically that I've ever written. I never like to write autobiographically, even though most of my books are set in Minnesota, and even though there's often a good Norwegian in there, and even though lots of the characters like candy, as I do. And Patty Jane's House of Curl is really an homage to my neighborhood, but I had no background in beauty salons at all. My mother was extremely proud of her naturally wavy hair and never went to the beauty salon for the weekly appointment as my friends' mothers did. So the characters in that book just came to me with the title, and I thought, whoa, it's a house of curl, and then I figured out it was a beauty salon and not, you know, some odd North Dakota sports arena. But this book, the character in it is a lot like me, although I think the delight for me of fiction is the surprise in writing. Because I started writing this, and I soon came to realize that her mother, and I named her Candy, but her mother turns out to be a Korean War bride. And I thought, whoa, where did that come from? And I thought, well, it did, and that's the truth of this character. And I got a book about Korean War brides and read that. And she does not have a good childhood. I had a good childhood. I had a really fun childhood. But her goals, you know, to perform stand-up comedy, to act, are the same that I shared. And she does move into the most fabulous Hollywood Boulevard apartment called Peyton Hall. That was the apartment my husband and I moved into. It had palm trees embossed on the wallpaper. It had rattan ceiling wallpaper, so it felt like you lived in a tiki-tiki hut. The swimming pool was designed by Douglas Fairbanks, and there were all these old tenants, you know, who'd drift by with their cigarettes and tell you that they were Veronica Lake stand-in, you know, and it reeked of old Hollywood. And we were there nearly 3 years when we got eviction notices slipped under our door, and a big conglomerate had bought the apartment and was going to tear it down. So we formed a tenants union. We tried to get it declared a historical landmark. We failed. It's now a really ugly 4 or 6 foot story condominium. Okay, so that is the one recurring dream I have in my life that, and I have it about 4 times a year. Peyton Hall is in the midst of being torn down, and there are still some apartments in the back that are half torn down, and I'm one of the squatters living in one of them. And I always wake up and I feel sort of disquieted, like, what does that mean? And so I thought, maybe it's finally time to write about that time in Hollywood. And we had so much fun. I had always wanted to be a writer, and that really was my first career goal, and specifically a novelist. But in my 20s, you know, I really wanted to have fun, and I wanted to have Meryl Streep's movie career. I thought that was good. So, you know, I wrote a lot of short fiction, and I would send it to magazines, which back then published short fiction. And I really don't think I had the maturity to write in my 20s a novel at all. I wrote monologues, I wrote sketches for my friends and I wrote my own stand-up comedy routines, and I wrote short fiction. Also performed a lot of comedy, was in a couple plays, and would audition for movies and TV shows, never exciting ones, and always really stupid parts, young ingenue roles, you know, the girlfriend role. Now what I would do to try out for a young ingenue. But the real fun of living in Hollywood is how you make your money. If you're not succeeding in, you know, your Hollywood career, you can temp, you can waitress. I waitressed at Schwab's, the famous Schwab's drugstore. I temped. I worked at record companies, movie companies, and once my temp agent called and she said,
we're sending you to the Playboy Mansion.
And I said,
no, you're not.
You know, I'm a feminist. I wasn't going to go to the Playboy Mansion, but she convinced me it was just clerical. So I decided no tails or ears. So I really decided to go like Margaret Mead investigating a secret culture. It was the only job my husband pleaded with me to drive him there. And we got there, and it's, you know, a big estate in Holmby Hills, and there's an iron gate and a little rock you talk into. It's got a speaker. Hi, this is Laura Lardmark. And the gates open, and peacocks strut by, and playmates were on the grounds. And I worked in Hugh Hefner's video room on the third floor, just cataloging the many, many videotapes Hugh Hefner would watch. And he would watch like a 30-second videotape of some playmate, you know, cutting a ribbon to open a Ralph's supermarket, you know, and I would have to type Barbie Benton opening Ralph's, you know, and so it was a really fun, simple-headed job. And so it appears in this book, but it's the Rogue Mansion and not the Playboy Mansion. And the playmates are the Rascalettes. But Candy does have the job I had, and she does have to occasionally drop videotapes off next to Hugh Hefner's round bed in his, well, his name is Duffel in this book, but I had to do that several times. I had to run into his room, but you know, he's got a faux fur, you're grimacing, I feel your pain. And I would drop the tapes off next to his bed, and I'd race out and wash my hands. But I also had the fun of being on a game show three times, because the guy that turned me on to game shows, anytime I went down to the pool, there was Jeff in an inner tube floating around in the middle of the pool. And finally I asked him, Jeff, do you work? And he said, well, I just won a $40,000 on a game show. And I said, wow, how do you do that? And he said, well, you got to audition, you have to take a general knowledge test and, you know, prove that you won't fall asleep when the cameras are on you. So I got on three game shows because at that time that was the limit. They didn't want you to home audiences see the same old people on the game show. So I think my biggest win was when I was on a $25,000 pyramid. And I got to go up to the pyramid three times. But I never won big because I was always the one who received the clues, as most of the contestants were. You could say, I want to give the clues, but I was too Minnesotan to do that. But I did win a trip to Tahiti with MacGyver. Thank you. He's from Robbinsdale, you know. He's a very nice guy. So in writing this book, and also, you know, the beauty of fiction, Candy gets on The Tonight Show. That really was my dream, to get on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. It didn't happen for me, but it happens for Candy. So I was thinking, what should I read to you? And I have been doing this event with some other writers, and they talk about their process, how they're writing. And one guy was saying how he keeps a journal. And I thought, man, I should maybe keep a journal. But I never do. I kept a journal in my early 20s and late teens, and I just burned them all because I sounded like a psychopath in them. You know, I think I just wrote when I was depressed or the world was, you know, pressing down on me. But Candy, she survives her very traumatic childhood by writing in a journal that, and she's named it, she calls her journal Cal, which is short for calendarium, which is Latin for daily ledger, and that's her sixth grade teacher turned her on to journal writing. So I just thought I'd read a few of her journal entries. You can get a little clue of Candy. So this is from June 4th, 1970. At the ripe old age of 14, I got my period. Grandma had given me a box of pads when I was 11 years old, and it was starting to seem like I'd never need them. And besides, my friend Leanne Jurdy and I use most of them to make houses, mostly igloos for our troll dolls, and sleeping bags for Ken and Barbie. I stayed up late, surprising Dad when he came home by giving him a big hug. He was so surprised he hugged me back, but it didn't take him long to let go and say, what's this all about? Oh, I just wanted you to know that I'm not a hermaphrodite like Charlotte said I was, and today I turned into a woman. Well, that's what I wanted to say, and it was sort of momentous news after all, but in the end, all I could say was nothing. Good night. You can tell she kind of has a rough relationship with her father. This is dated October 1st, 1971. Dear Cal, we had a laugh-off assembly at school for April Fool's Day, and the sophomores ruled. Tom Schmitz dressed up in a gray wig and a baggy dress and sang Folsom Prison in an old lady voice. Matt Triggs dressed up in a blonde wig and shorts and a tank top and did a cheerleading routine. I dressed up in a man's suit and tucked my hair up into a hat and gave a speech called, What I Expect From You Brats. The first big laugh came right after I introduced myself as Mr. Welby, our school principal. Afterwards, Mr. Welby came up to me and said he didn't know whether to be flattered or suspend me. And then we'll move a little further. And this is in 1973. It's February 14th. So it's coming close to 42 years. Wow. Okay. Dear Cal, another cry day. On a scale of 1 to 10, about an 8. After English class, I ditched school and took a bus to the Electric Fetus, figuring I might as well buy myself a Valentine. When I was up at the cashier paying for Exile on Main Street, I hear this voice saying, Excellent choice, candy bar. It was Jim Clark, my childhood crush. I spent a lot of time admiring him from afar, i.e. my bedroom window, watching him jump in and out of cars filled with yelling, joking high school boys and girls, and once watching him pose on his front step with his prom date, wishing I was that girl in the pink dress and blonde page boy who held his hand and laughed when Mrs. Clark pointed her camera and said, Geez! Anyway, from what Mrs. Clark told Grandma, he's had a hard time since he got back from Vietnam, and I admit, I hardly recognized him with his Fu Manchu mustache and scraggly beard. Jim Clark, I haven't seen you in forever. Seems that way. You're all grown up. Then he said that surely I wasn't old enough to be out of school yet, and I said, no, I'm a junior. And then he said, a truant junior, and asked if I wanted to go for a ride, and I said, sure. He fired up a joint, and we drove toward the river road, listening to Ride, Captain, Ride, and Smiling Faces sometimes. And when In the Summertime came on, he said, Do you know who sings this? Mungo Jerry. Do you know where the name Mungo Jerry came from? At the stupid names for a band store? Jim laughed. No, from a T.S. Eliot poem. Our fun and mellow drive changed when he blurted out how sorry he was he didn't go to my dad's services because funerals are hard for him. Good old Mr. Pecola, he said and sighed. Every now and then I'd wander over to your garage late at night when your dad was in there working on his car or just sitting there smoking. So we'd talk. You would? I said, my throat clogging up. About what? Jim scratched his name tag sewn on the front of his camouflage jacket. Everything, really. Cars, sports, politics. He was really mad that Johnson didn't run for a second term. He was? Yeah, he hated the war, and he thought Johnson was finally wising up and would have gotten us out a lot earlier. Jim took a deep final toke of the joint. When I got drafted, he gave me his lucky Indian head penny, the one he carried all through Korea. I felt like we were talking about someone I'd never met, and when I told him it was the 3-month anniversary of my dad dying, he said we had to go to Fort Snelling Stat and pay our respects. So we drove out by the airport to the cemetery, which is huge and filled with row after row after row of white headstones that seemed to go on forever. First, we stopped at the grave of one of Jim's friends, and he knelt down, his hands running over the engraving like he was reading Braille. The date made me feel like my lungs weren't working, 1949 to 1968. A plane roared overhead, and I wondered if from way up high, all those tombstones and all those lines look like dominoes, and if you flick them with a finger, they'd all fall down. My dad's grave didn't have its permanent marble headstone yet, more unfinished business, and Jim put his arm around me as we squatted in front of it, and I bawled like a baby. Life's a bitch, Candy, he said, and then he was crying. I feel like I don't know anything.
We've reached one of the best parts of the Fireside series, the Q&A with the author and our dedicated audience. It's a chance to go beyond the book, connecting readers and writers on a deeper level. To make it easier for you, the listener, I've summarized the questions and we'll read them. First up, an audience member asked about Landvik's background as a novelist. How did she first start writing novels?
So how did I get started writing novels? That is a very good question. When we lived in Los Angeles, we had our first daughter in 1985, which was right around the time Gorbachev came into power. And I had a dream that I was Gorbachev's temp secretary. And the United States had sent a nuclear bomb to Russia, and Russia had until high noon to respond, and I was just a temp, you know, and a Minnesotan, and I didn't know how to counsel Gorbachev to not retaliate. And I woke up and I was so scared. And I looked over my little baby's crib and thought, what kind of world have we brought you into? And I can't say that I live by my dreams, my nocturnal dreams. If I did, I'd be institutionalized. But that dream was literally the first in many, many steps. We heard about a peace march called the Global Peace March. Oh, what was it called? I forgot now. We will have peace. The Global Peace March for Worldwide Nuclear Disarmament, or something like that. My memory. And we, along with 1,000 people, walked, left Los Angeles in our North Face tents, and in beautiful Barstow, California, all the funding ran out. And over half the marchers left, and those of us remaining kept on. And it became a real grassroots movement. Farmers would bring out truckloads of produce, and people would invite us into their homes to do laundry, which was needed. And we walked from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. Took us 9 months. It was that same year as Hands Across America, remember that? And that got all the publicity, and our little joke was we were going to cut through their line. Because we thought, come on. Although we did get on the Phil Donahue show when we finally got to New York. But it was fabulous, and it was awful, and everything in between. You know, to walk a good day, an easy day was like 11 miles. Every morning we were given the map of the route. We had an advance team, and they were mimeographed. So it's really fun to see all these adults, you know. And a long day was like 25 to 28 miles. And if you walked with one person a day, you would learn their whole life story. And there was a daycare bus, so our daughter was on the daycare bus, and my husband and I, you had to work 2 days within the camp, so both of us volunteered on the daycare bus. They also had a school bus, a post office truck. So it was just a fabulous way to see the country, but, you know, your privacy's very impinged on when you're living in a camp with, you know, people whose tent is a foot away from yours. And but, you know, we've been asked so many times, well, what, why would you do something like that? What good did it do? And I've always been a proponent of, you know, a good demonstration against something that needs to be demonstrated against. And there has been no nuclear war, so you're welcome. But in answer to your question, so, see, one question I tend to wander. But when we got back to Los Angeles, I realized that I didn't need Meryl Streep's career. She was doing a pretty good job of it. And I thought, I can always act back in Minneapolis, St. Paul. You know, we have such a great theater scene. And I think it's time now for me to write my first novel, like I've always thought I would do. And so very conveniently, when I decided that, the characters of that first novel and the title came into my head. And I never write by outline. I don't really know what's going to happen until I get there. And then, so my writing is, the characters are pretty vivid in my head. I don't know them a lot, but I know them enough to start. And then the more I write, the more I learn, the more I learn, the more I go back and change things. So when we moved back here, I got a job at Dudley Riggs acting, and I also took a class at the Loft when it was at the old Playwright Center. And the class was for people who were in the midst of writing a novel, and we would just exchange 20 pages of our novel with other classmates and then critique them. So I thought, this isn't a really, really long short story. It is a novel. So I would come back home from, you know, having a performance and just be all wired, and I'd write late into the night. And I had handwritten Patty Jane. And the Nokomis Library was open till 9 o'clock on Mondays and Thursday nights. And so those were my office hours when I would write a lot of my novel. And then I typed it up on a very clackety Brothers typewriter. And I was very heartened in typing it up. And I had just done a show. I'd come home. It was about 2 a.m. and clack, clack, clackety, clack, clack, clack. It was a rainy May night. And all of a sudden, I realized my hands were wet. And I thought, oh, do we have a leak? And I realized I was crying. And I was so glad, because I was crying over the death of a particular character, whose death I certainly knew had happened, because I had written that scene a couple times. But it was as if the typing made it so real, and I was, oh. And I thought that was so good. If I were crying, maybe some readers would cry. And I think that's always how I approach my writing, from a reader standpoint, because I love to read. I love to be taken into somebody else's world and feel for the characters and root for them and dislike others. So that's what I want my job to be as a writer.
Next up, an audience member asked why none of Lanvick's novels have been adapted to the big screen. Is there anything in the works?
Would somebody work on that, please? I'll repeat the question. Well, first of all, she said some really nice things. And then she was asking, why haven't there been any movies? And I'm sure you've heard me say that Patty Jane has been optioned for years, and it never comes to pass. They get people interested, and then it falls through. I always like to tell the story of getting a phone call, and when I was making spaghetti one night, and you know, which means I was warming ragu, and the woman on the phone said, "Hi, Lorna. This is Ashley Judd. I'm calling from the ICU ward in I can't remember the city in Kentucky." And my mind was reeling. Ashley Judd, ICU ward, you know. And, oh, she said, my pawpaws had a stroke, and I was thinking, pawpaw, you know. Well, you don't have a pawpaw. I really thought it was one of my actor friends just messing with me. And so I said, hi, Ash. But it was really Ashley. And she was interested in playing the part of Harriet, who has a really good part. I mean, you get to be drunk, you get to You get a whole arc of emotions. And but then she went on to do Divine Secrets of the Aya Sisterhood, and that fell through. But she did tell me this wonderful story that I direct to all the men here, because I know my books sometimes don't have titles that make you think,
yeah, I'm going to go out and buy that on Angry Housewives Eating Bonbons right away, that's for sure.
She said, I gave it to a friend of mine recuperating from heart surgery, and he loved it. He bought 10 copies for his friends and relatives. And then she said, it was Arnold Schwarzenegger. So I could just see Arnold.
That Patty Jane's also calling for that.
And then I could see him groping a nurse. But so something may be in the work for another book, but I'm a little superstitious. But I don't know. I'm a movie fan. I love movies. I know there's a danger in your books being turned into crappy movies. But I know sometimes books are made into really wonderful movies. So I would hope for the latter. And then, you know, I would also wheedle a part in for myself. Just a little one. Okay, and you too. Yeah, I just want that free dental insurance, you know, through my SAG membership. Yeah.
The next question is about the magnetic characters and groups Landvik creates in her novel. Does Landvik herself belong to such a group?
You know, I, as much as there is to despair at in today's world, and I think there's a lot, I think I was blessed just with a natural optimism. Even though I can really get dark, I really believe in people. I'm fascinated by people. I want to figure out what makes us tick. I know we all have our own very compelling story, and I want to know that. When I was a kid, I had great friends, and we were all tomboys, and we just had the freedom that I certainly didn't give my own girls. You know, I turned into one of those hover parents. I leashed them until they were 18, but I kid. And I remember just being in that unit, and we felt so powerful. Both my parents had a lot of siblings, and I saw those really tight groups. I actually belong to a Norwegian women's club at all. And, but we only meet once a month to hear a speaker and to eat pickled cucumbers. But I would say my friends and my husband and my daughters, that's my really good core group. I have a really good book club too. I figure I think this might be my slogan. We're all in this together, you know. So how do we help each other through it? That doesn't always include liquor.
Following that question, an audience member asks if comedy is something that's innate or can be learned.
I think you can probably do both. I know a lot of comics personally who in real life, I think, you know, but who know how to write a joke. I think some people learn, you know, that they're, if they get a laugh, they realize, oh, I like that, and that they learn to build on what initially got them that laugh. I know I grew up with three brothers, and so, you know, it was helpful to make people laugh to avoid. And my friends really reinforced that too, and I was always the youngest. I have a December birthday, and at that time they let you be in school when you'd start school when you were four. So I still always think I'm the youngest, even if I'm in a group with 20-year-olds, I'll think, yeah, where are we going? You know? So So I think being the youngest, too, I always wanted to assert myself. But for me, humor was always very, very important. And my parents were funny, good storytellers. So I got that reinforced that way, too. But as I said, I do know people who really want to perform comedy and who, while they're not funny in real life, know how to turn it on stage. Candy meets a woman, a performer, who's based on the experience I had when my friend and I, who I did perform stand-up comedy with, we went to see Lily Tomlin in San Francisco. And we met her backstage, and we, "Oh, Miss Tomlin, do you have any advice for us?" You know, and we were both wearing matching tuxedo T-shirts, and she looked at us like, "Oh, get a clue," you know. And she said, "Yeah, life's a shit sandwich. You only gotta eat the bread." We thought, "Thanks a lot, Miss Tomlin." Can I say that on podcasts? I'm quoting, I'm not saying it myself. So.
Next up, an audience member asks how Landvik landed her first publisher.
Yes, how I found my first publisher. I like to tell this story because I know there might be other writers out there, and it sometimes seems so grim and hopeless. And I, from my local library, would study the writer's market. I couldn't check it out because it was reference book, but it tells you everything you need to know about formatting a manuscript, how to write a query letter, lists all sorts of agents' addresses, publishers' addresses. It tells what agents have represented what books. So I blanketed Manhattan with a query letter. And they say write a one-page, because, you know, they don't want to take the effort of turning a page, letter that'll capture somebody's interest, a little bit about yourself, a little bit about the book. Jazz it up, make it as compelling as you can. So the mail was so fun to receive every day, and most of it included lots of just postcards that said, you know, that checked off, not interested. And then I got some letters, send me a couple chapters. And finally, I can't tell you, it's probably a year and a half, I got an agent. But she was the wrong agent for me. She was submitting Patty Jane to romance publishers who would write back saying, "This isn't a romance, why are you sending it to us?" And I thought, I think I know more than my agent does about what publishers would send it. So I got another agent. She called me up during that, remember that snowstorm of 91 on Halloween? And I had just had another baby, but I was out with my then 6-year-old, you know, making sure a little blizzard wasn't going to stop her, you know, because I like that candy bag. And so she calls me the next day when we were shoveling out and said, I kind of like these women. I want to represent you. And then I had asked that she send me all the rejection letters because I wanted to see what they were saying. And at that time, this was in the early 90s, you know, it wasn't email, it was letters. And most of them said the same thing, and they would be very positive, and sometimes I think they were acceptance letters, and and then the last sentence would be, "But I don't know what to do with this." And I would think, well, how about publish it? And, so it took, I think, 30 publishers saw it before a very small press called Bridgeworks said yes. And they didn't give any advance, so I got no money initially. But then the summer it was sold, I was getting really fun phone calls like, "Germany bought the rights. You know, somebody wants to, you know, represent it for a movie," that still hasn't happened. So it was, and then three of the publishers who had refused it as a hardcover were then bidding for the right to publish it in paperback. So Bridgewood was very small, but the company was fronted by a couple, and the man had been the former publisher of the Wall Street Journal. So he had a lot of pull with media outlets. I guess that's what you call it, media outlets. So I really got a lot of press, I think much more than I would have had he not been able to call up his friends and, yeah, I got an audition, yeah. And so I tell any writer, you know, really that's what I'm most proud of, is my persistence. I thought I wasn't going to accept anyone's no until I thought it was finally time to say no myself. You know, I had gotten rejected in Hollywood, and that's harder when you're rejected, you know, to your face. And when you get rejected as a writer, you know, you read your rejection letter, you talk back, you know, and you just know that it's historically so many writers have their multitude of rejection stories, and you kind of feel like you're in that clan. And there's a wonderful little teeny book called Rotten Rejections, and I would often refer to that because it's a compendium of all these books that got terrible rejection letters and went on to win, you know, Pulitzer Prizes and be huge bestsellers. So, yeah, and yeah, that Pulitzer Prize made me feel a lot better, I tell you. Did that answer your question? Okay.
The next question is about Landvik's own reading taste. Does she have a favorite book or author, and how has it influenced her writing?
Well, I love to read. I don't have the gift my mother had. My mom could read a book a night. She just, you know, it's the gift of speed. I don't have it. I'm a dawdler. Right now, I am reading, anytime I get asked this, I get flummoxed. I forget what I'm reading. I'm reading Sandy Benitez's book, A Place Where the Sea Remembers. I'm reading a nonfiction book. And what's it about? It'll come to me. I would say that if I had to choose a favorite book, my favorite book might be many favorite people's favorite books, and that is To Kill a Mockingbird, which, yes, I did.
Are you excited about that?
Well, I will tell you this. When I first read it in eighth grade, To Kill a Mockingbird, in Nokomis Junior High, and it was such a thrill because the class was taught by my teacher, Mrs. Harper. And she was from Birmingham, Alabama. And, you know, it was like synchronicity. So you've all heard, I'm sure, that they found this long-lost manuscript that Harper Lee wrote before To Kill a Mockingbird, and that her agent said, oh, I like Scout when she's little, let's cull her story and write a new book, and then that was set aside. And I've heard people say, no, I won't read it, and no, I don't want it to destroy her legacy. And then I think I will read it, because even if I don't like it, it won't mar that jewel for me that is To Kill a Mockingbird. And, you know, it's so subjective. People say, well, why put it out if it can't match To Kill a Mockingbird? And it might match it for one or two readers or a multitude of readers. You know, I've had people tell me so many times that this book is their favorite or that book is their favorite. And I love it when people tell me books that aren't often mentioned and the ones that they tell me their favorite. You know, I even got told 'Tis the Season, my long forgotten little Christmas book, was somebody's favorite, and I had to make out with them, you know. it might mean wonderful things to other readers, and if it doesn't mean that to me, that's okay, because To Kill a Mockingbird sure did. So.
The second to last question is about Landvik's relationship with editors past and present. Has she had a long-term editor or a favorite editor?
My first editor was she was a freelance editor for this very small press. So they said, she's got great credentials. She teaches at Columbia. She has written for the New York Times. And yet she would call me up and say things like, what is a Norwegian? Right? Person from Norway. And she had that very provincial idea that, you know, anything west of the East River was, you know, Amish or something. And she'd say, can you really get a taxi cab in Minneapolis on New Year's Eve? And, you know, we have a fleet. But she did what no other editor since has done. And she would try to line edit me. And that's when they cross out words, they change things, they rewrite lines to the point I thought she was really taking, like, if I set up not a joke, but something that I hoped would have a comic payoff, you know, she would change the words so it didn't work. And I cried to my agent. I said, she's wrecking my book. And my agent's advice was just retype the pages that she's red marked, and we'll resubmit them and see if she notices. And we did. And she didn't. My second editor at Ballantine Books was a formidable woman. And you know, publishing was a very sexist business, as many of them are, thanks a lot, guys. But so women, for the longest time, you know, were assistants. They were never given positions of authority. My first editor at Ballantine had been an assistant. I can't remember the publishing house, but, you know, she would read all the books that came over the transom in the slush pile, and one, she just pressed on her boss, saying, you've got to publish this. This is going to be big. And he was sort of dismissive, but did read it, and they published it. It was Peyton Place. And so she had all sorts of stories. I thought she was a really good editor, and I think all of my editors since have been really good in that they'll write me like a two-page letter with that ask questions. Like, what about this guy here? And it'll make me think rather than they're not scolding me and saying, this is tripe, you gotta get rid of that. You know, they'll just make me ponder something. And then they've always been very open to accepting what I say as, you know, if I think, nope, this is exactly how I want it, fine. So I've had a pretty good relationship with editors. Okay, we only have 4 more hours, so.
Finally, an audience member asked Landvik about her childhood. How did her experience growing up influence her writing?
I grew up in South Minneapolis. I went to Morris Park, where I had my most important teacher ever as far as my writing goes, Mr. Spaeth, in 6th grade. He really believed in my writing, and he would send my poems to a radio station that broadcast student work, and I would hear them come over the PA system, and I would be just so thrilled and so Norwegian. I would listen to him like this. But he wrote in my little autograph book, best of luck for a fine literary career. And I just, wow. And I never forgot that. So I acknowledged him in my second book, but I couldn't remember his name, you know, because when you're a kid, you don't, your teachers don't have first names, you know. So I just acknowledged him as Mr. Spaeth, the way I had addressed him as a kid. The Star Tribune did a story about me, and I told them all about Mr. Spaeth, so they looked him up for me, and it wasn't heavy detective work. He lived in Bloomington. But we met at the Baker Square for pie and coffee. And he brought his wife, and now I'm an adult, and I can speak to them by their first names, and so I was introduced to his wife, whose name was Mary, and turns out Mr. Spaeth's name was Joseph. So I had pie and coffee with Mary and Joseph, and I really believe that fiction always can't be trumped by nonfiction, because the busboy's name tag, this is true, was Jesus. So I had I went to Nokomis Junior High, which is now it was torn down. It's now a senior high rise. I went to Roosevelt High School after Jesse Ventura. But I had I just had a very free and open to possibilities childhood. My mother had eight girls and one boy in her family. And so I think I was always, I had a feminist, girls can do anything bent. My dad certainly supported that in me. And I had really good friends who were just so much fun. I mean, we would do wild things, and not bad wild, you know, although there were some football captain's houses we had to teepee, but you know, nothing like that. And Minneapolis was such a great place to grow up. You know, we would go to Lake Nokomis at 6 a.m. and pack a lunch and go swimming by ourselves, no lifeguard. You know, things you don't let kids do nowadays. But you know, the 1890s, they were a different time. But I'm such a fan of public schools. I'm such a fan of public libraries. And I don't like how funding and diminishment of these public places, I don't like how that's happening. After high school, my best friend and I traveled to Europe for a year. We didn't want to go right to school. And we wound up being chambermaids in Garmisch-Partenkirchen. So I learned German, although most of my German has to do with cleaning terms. So we spent a fabulous year there hitchhiking, you know, through the continent. And yes, I feel very, very lucky about my childhood. I always had a really good dog, you know, from our first dog was Satin, who could say hamburger. Smartest dog I've ever met. Our second dog was Gomer, who might have gotten kicked in the head, in utero or something. He was a little slow, but, and then we had Tina, and I mean, it was just a really fun childhood, even though, you know, in the 60s there were those drills, you know, duck and cover drills, so my life was beautiful, but there definitely were undercurrents of real life going on. Anyway, thank you so much for coming. I will sign books. I would prefer that they're mine. Again, thanks for coming out on this cold night and dry.
You've been listening to the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. The next episode will feature Minnesota Book Award finalist Alan Eskins reading from his debut novel, The Life We Bury. Until then, we hope you consider supporting the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library and its mission, stronger libraries for stronger communities. Learn more at thefriends.org. Follow us on Twitter at The Friends and on Facebook at facebook.com/friendsofsppl. Please consider subscribing to this podcast on iTunes.